The United States versus Thoroughbred Tech. Right, counsel.
Good morning, Your Honor, counsel. Your Honors, when the parties filed their complaint and settlement in this case, there were two real claims that existed. A slander of title claim and a declaratory relief claim. No trespass claim existed at the time the settlement was filed and the complaint was filed together.
Then why was the jurisdictional amount satisfied?
Your Honor, they have alleged that the jurisdictional amount was satisfied, I believe, because of the amount which would be required to defend the declaratory relief and the injunctive relief.
Against only Mr. Elsinger?
I think their position, if I understand their position correctly, is that even as against one single parcel, the amount that would be necessary to do that would exceed the amount.
So one would have to do a defendant's viewpoint approach to jurisdiction.
That is what the plaintiffs contend, Your Honor.
And you are?
I'm an intervener.
I know you're an intervener,
yeah.
But if there's no jurisdiction over the case, you aren't intervening into anything.
Correct, Your Honor. So that's correct.
That's
I agree.
That's why I'm asking.
Certainly. Certainly. Thank you. Your Honor, the fact that there was no trespass claim, the plaintiffs and the parties see that as the beauty of this settlement, that is that they settled a case where the trespass had not yet occurred. We suggest to Your Honor that is the fatal flaw of this settlement and the reason that it failed for adequacy, among other reasons. At the time this case was filed, 58,000 class members had exactly the same claims, they had exactly the same damage calculation, and they had the exact same extraordinary leverage. Why did they have extraordinary leverage? Because T-Cube said, we have to have access to both sides of the track. We don't know which side we're going to use, but because of topography and other factors, we may have to jump from one side to the other. So we need to settle this case so that we can do what otherwise would be a trespass in the future on whichever side we want. Armed with that leverage, since no trespass had occurred, every single interest was identical.
But Mr. Levin, it seems to me there are only a limited number of possibilities for the way for how to handle this case. One of them, you know, at least to some people's mind, one of them is the way it was handled, which was to have an ex ante determination of the rights before anybody knew where the cable was going to be laid. Another possibility would be to say that the case simply isn't ripe until all of these trespasses start occurring, in which case we'd have to throw everything out and start over again, and you would deprive people of the opportunity to resolve this kind of case in advance. Another possibility would be to say, well, we can do it in advance, but we'll appoint two guardians ad litem, one guardian ad litem for the people who wind up being on the cable side, the other guardian ad litem for the people who wind up being on the non-cable side, who have a very limited trespass for purposes of engineering surveys and so on, but who don't have the long-term one. But that looks an awful lot like a hypothetical trumped-up kind of lawsuit. And I think that the problem one faces is whether the law of standing or the law of rightness actually precludes courts from resolving these kinds of controversies before the bulldozers have moved in, or at least before the engineers have walked onto the land. And it seems to me the logic of your position is there's simply no way to do it.
Your Honor, there is a way to do it. Maybe there's a way to do it. But my first answer is that maybe there isn't a way to do it. You know, in AmChem, they tried to solve a problem too. They tried to solve a problem that actually would have been in the class entire interest, because as we know today, many of those asbestos companies are out of business, and some of those claimants are going to receive nothing. But in AmChem, the court said, you know what, the future claims, you just can't reach them.
But of course, you would agree that there were far more, I mean, maybe in the spectrum of things, there are far more uncertainties in the AmChem situation than we have here. Maybe we still have too many here. I'm not saying that, but AmChem, you know, the list of hypotheticals goes on for a paragraph in the Supreme Court's opinion.
Yes, but in AmChem, we even had class representatives that crossed virtually the entire spectrum of the potential plaintiffs. Here, we certainly don't have that. The other way that you could possibly solve this case, possibly, is what the district court asked to class counsel. The district court said, in your consideration of ways to protect both sets of clients, did you consider taking that $6,000 payment that the future trespass people were going to get, the cable side? Did you consider that and maybe think about giving three to both sides? Because they're both in the identical same position.
But they aren't after the... They're in the same... Think of it as a two-part process. There's the engineering survey process, and then there's the laying of the cable process. They're both similarly situated for purposes of that initial trespass, if you will, the initial entry onto the land. So what the district court could have asked, but didn't perhaps, was did you consider structuring the settlement so that the people whose land the cable winds up on get $5,500 and the people whose land is only surveyed get $500?
Your Honor, what Your Honor I think is attempting to do is to solve a problem that did not yet exist.
But see, you can't have your class representative for the non-cable side before we know which is the non-cable side,
Judge,
unless it's a guardian ad litem.
I might suggest that there is no way to settle this case in futuro. I might suggest that that is exactly the problem. Indeed, if you look at the Petrovic case, which is the case where, which is a little different, it's not in futuro, but where the court, where the district court sort of relied on having one class and having separate classes within one class. In Petrovic, that court went to great pains to distinguish itself from AmChem and from Ortiz. And what they said was, no, in Petrovic, the district court had been hands-on with that case for 3 years. It could have modified the class, it was familiar with the class, and so on and so forth. But it said what was crucial is that there were 33 different class representatives who were there. And those 33 class representatives covered the gamut of the three zones which were created. Here, I didn't select the class representatives. The class counsel selected one class representative for this. And I would submit that there was a reason for doing that, and that was this veil of ignorance theory, which we think does not suggest the appropriate position for a class representative. And
but isn't quite Rawls. I mean, this isn't a person who's up there trying to create policy for the whole world. This is a guy who has the land. The cable might be on his land, or he might have a limited trespass. He has a strong incentive to litigate this case. And there's another problem here. I mean, maybe you're right, and maybe there's simply no way to settle these kinds of cases, and thus the litigation has to go forward with huge transaction costs. But the fact of the matter is, a lot of very big companies were satisfied with this settlement, thought that it actually did approximate what would have happened after the fact.
Your Honor, in
AmChem, go ahead.
In AmChem, every single asbestos company thought it was great. A lot of plaintiffs thought it was great. True, there was opposition to it.
There's
no
more
question.
Opposition, yeah.
No question about it. And the class was obviously much larger than this class. But, you know, this court has held in the GM engine interchange case this observation that the court, to be sure, will not approve a settlement if it is unfair, but fairness may be found anywhere within a broad range of lower and upper limits. No one can tell whether a compromise found to be fair might not have been fairer had the negotiations possessed better information and been animated by undivided loyalty to the cause of the class. Let's take that one step further, if I may. The fact of the matter is that adequacy includes advocacy. And what the affidavit of Mr. Elzinga says is, I tried to do a settlement that was fair and reasonable. Here's the problem with that approach. The problem is that T-Cubed wasn't negotiating for fair and reasonable. They were negotiating for the best deal they could. Mr. Elzinga was negotiating for a global deal that would work for both sides.
For the two different sides of the track.
Correct.
I mean, he was trying to get the most money for both cable side and non-cable side, as I understand his affidavit, not for TQ.
That's not what his affidavit says. His affidavit said he was trying to get a deal that was fair and reasonable. Fair and reasonable is what a court does when it looks down into the valley of the battle of negotiations. The duty of the class representative is to fight as hard as he can to get the best price that he can for his people. Mr. Elzinga's goal, as stated in his affidavit, was to get something that was fair and reasonable for everyone.
But the court decided it was the best thing for both, for the class.
Your Honor, the problem with the court's approach to this is the court, I believe, had sort of missed the point, if you will, on class representation. In our colloquy during the oral argument, as you'll see in the record, the court said, well, does your client want to be the class representative?
Right, I
said, no, we're not doing that. I see I have only time for rebuttal.
That's right.
It's back to you.
Well, let me finish with one more point, and that is this. This court or LLC concept is, we believe, violative of Agent Orange. In Agent Orange, the court dealt with gravy money, if you will. The money that was left over after class members who were assertive enough to actually exert their rights had already taken all their money. And the court set up a foundation and said, let's use this extra money. You take care of it and divvy it up and give programs to the class members. And the court said, can't do it. The court has the obligation to do that. It's the court's settlement. The court has responsibility. Under the court or LLC paradigm, the court is now completely uninvested. If there are any disputes, it doesn't even go back to the court. It goes to arbitration in Washington, D.C., where class counsel is from. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Kathleen Kaufman, I'm one of the counsel representing the plaintiff class in this action.
Can you talk louder, please?
I'm
that
sorry?
That is not amplified.
This is not amplified?
No.
Well, then we'll try real hard, and you'll
Thank
let
you.
Me know if I don't actually make it. Rule 23 defines both procedural and subjective ways for determining what is in the best interest of absent class members in class actions. In this case, you have practically no disagreement, or I would say no disagreement, about what the law is that must be applied to the situation. What you've got a disagreement on is whether or not these facts applied to that law permit the certification of a class at this time and approval of this settlement.
And here, as I see it anyway, is the nub of the problem that Mr. Levin is arguing about. When all is said and done, some people are going to have a greater intrusion on their rights than others. And if you read through the settlement, you can see that there's the perpetual easement, assuming that T-Cubed lays the cable and so forth, for the people on the cable side. And the non-cable side people have a limited intrusion up front while the decision is being made where to lay the cable, but not thereafter. And the hypothetical question that we need to confront is, would this allocation of benefits inside the class, they're all property owners, I suppose, you know, in general, half of them will wind up being cable side and half of them will wind up not being, although I realize somebody might be both, but
right.
Half
the property will end up one way,
roughly,
and half the other.
Roughly speaking, we're looking at 50-50. And we don't see any way of resolving intra-class conflicts. It's all sort of going on, if you will, inside Mr. Elzinga's head or inside your representation, and we don't see any way of resolving that kind of a problem. And so I come to you with the same question. Ex ante, is there any way to do this before the cable's laid, before we know at least where it's going to be laid?
Yes, is the short answer. The district court in this case looked very carefully at the claim that Mr. Elzinga could not represent both sides of the track. She exercised her discretion. She looked at the facts. She looked at what she knew over the year of supervising the settlement. She looked at this settlement three times. She looked at it in October. She looked at it in April. And she looked at it again in August at the final fairness hearing. And she found that Mr. Elzinga had claims typical of the class, and was an adequate representative in the face of objections and briefs which were quite strenuous and raised the just disability argument that Your Honor raises, which they have not brought forward to this court because they raised it there. They spent 99% of their briefs on it. The court looked at it, looked at the pleadings, resolved it in our favor, and they have rejected it as a proper argument to bring forth to you.
Can you give me other examples of litigation problems of class actions where ex ante the class members didn't know in which of two classes they would fall, and then after an event happens or after things transpire, they do know? I mean, it's very common in life that, you know, Monday morning quarterbacking or hindsight or whatever you want might enable you to get more money for yourself, but we often negotiate in less than perfect information.
Absolutely, Your Honor. In every settlement that I can think of, unless it is one where all class members are going to get $3.50. I got one of those class notices last week. I was quite pleased that it was going to be credited back against my credit card. In every one, the class members need to go through some process, and some of them will get money and some of them won't. In addition, in the ordinary litigated class context, you get a notice, you are in a class, a complaint has been filed. You have an obligation then to evaluate whether or not you want to stay in or opt out, and you don't know if there's going to be any settlement. You don't know if you're going to lose. And that is considered to be perfectly appropriate protection of absent class members' rights under Rule 23.
Are you conceding, by the way, that Kathy Mason is in fact a member of the class?
Kathy,
I realize there was this fuzziness about the fact that she wasn't a property owner and then didn't send things in. And
let me tell you what I know about Kathy Mason. Kathy Mason is not on the list of class members. To gather the list of class members, a contractor was hired who went out and looked at property records and compiled the list of everybody in the tax rolls that appeared to have property on either side of the tracks. We knew that that process was not going to be perfect. It took place over a 7-month period. It cost $1 million. It was very time-consuming and very difficult, and Judge Barker worked with us very closely on it. There was a provision in the notice that if you received this notice and you did not own the property, you were to give it to the property owner that you had sold it to. There was also, in key areas, public notice, newspaper notice, and there was a provision for registering yourself and instructions for registering yourself on the roll. All we know from her counsel is the statement in the brief. We have absolutely no affidavit, no information on Kathy Mason. No one has ever heard or seen of her. We have an allegation in the motion to intervene that she owns 200 feet on one of the settlement quarters. At that point, without ever talking to Ms. Mason, because she was represented by counsel, class counsel asked an investigator in Georgia to find out who Kathy Mason was and if, in fact, she owned any property, because she was nowhere on our list. And we discovered that a property transfer had happened between the time the contractor had looked at the very situation we had accounted for. She was not on the list. She was in the class, but she was not on the class list. In order to qualify for benefits under the class, she had to file a roll registration form. We are approaching this claims process with an eye towards ultimate fairness to the class members. If you miss that deadline, you send a letter in to the claims administrator and say, oops, I didn't know. I didn't get the notice. I was in Europe. I was in a coma. And then the claims administrator looks at it and decides whether or not that's good cause for having missed the deadline and makes a judgment. In this case, Ms. Mason's counsel has stated on the record that she got that notice when everyone else got the notice. She's clearly represented by very competent counsel. I was frankly waiting for them to get around to filing the claims registration form, and they never did. And when we raised it in our brief, the response was not, oops, we'll get on that right away, because our client, on our advice, has not opted out of this settlement. The cash portion of the settlement is compensation which we think is very valuable, and maybe she's going to be it, and we want her to get that. They did not say, we'll file a rural registration form and throw ourselves on the mercy of the claims administrator. They said in their reply brief, we don't want your benefits. We don't want your compensation. So the fact is that Kathy Mason will have an easement recorded against her property because her property is in this class. Her counsel have not registered her. Her counsel have told her, presumably, not to opt out. Maybe she made that decision on her own. I don't know. No one has ever heard from her.
But you would agree she's a member of the class,
yes.
But perhaps because she hasn't registered properly under the terms of the settlement, assuming, obviously, if the settlement's not approved, that's a different matter. But if it's approved, finally, she just hasn't taken the procedural steps necessary to get the benefit.
I maintain that she will not get shares of class quarter, she will not get class, and before this panel, she has no standing to object to anything having to do with the nature of the benefits coming out of that class.
Okay.
She simply has no interest in it.
Sorry.
Okay. The actions Judge Barker took were textbook example of how a district court judge ought to deal with a disputed settlement class and approval of a settlement. She had voluminous briefing. She had affidavits from us on the value of the settlement, on the nature of the representation. She had a hearing. She had absolutely no affidavits from the objectors. They had many arguments before her. Few of the arguments that you are actually hearing today were actually presented to Judge Barker. But she heard and listened to each one of those arguments, including the justiciability argument, which I will address if Your Honor wishes me to. She issued a very thorough opinion. She exercised her discretion well, and under the rules of this circuit, there is no evidence that she abused that discretion.
But, you know, there's something about this settlement. I mean, it's obviously unusual, and your opponents are arguing, for instance, that in the Agent Orange case, the Second Circuit said, you know, you can't just go around creating new companies out of whole cloth, and you don't even know, and obviously everyone in this courtroom knows that the fate of telecommunications companies in the stock market of late has been problematic. It's innovative, I'll give you that, but is it too innovative?
Well, that was within the discretion of the district court to decide. The district court had many affidavits on the nature of the compensation, and she also knew how many different levels of relief were for the class in this action. This court circuit says that you look at the settlement as a whole. When you look at the settlement as a whole, you see many parts. First of all, on a slander of title action, the usual relief is a declaration of your rights and the recovery of attorney's fees. Every member of this class got that relief. And if we had stopped there, we would have provided a fair, adequate, and reasonable settlement to this class.
But would you have had the jurisdictional amount?
Yes, I would have had the jurisdictional amount. Why don't I do this? Why don't I, if it pleases the court, go through what the compensation was, and I will address jurisdiction at the end of it. They got a declaration. They got their attorney's fees paid. In addition, something that I would submit was not necessary to fairly and adequately settle the claims in front of her. They got their easements consolidated in a way that made them economically valuable, which they are not, sitting in their individual hands because of the history of what has been done to abuse those rights. They had some asset compensation coming into the corporation, and they got shares in Class Corridor LLC. The difference with Agent Orange was in Agent Orange there was a fund, an undefined, the dollars were defined, but the uses of the fund were undefined. And the ability of each class member to participate in that fund was undefined. In this case, you get one share of Class Corridor LLC for every 10 feet that you own. And it is just exactly like any class action, the resolution of which involves the issuance of warrants in a publicly traded corporation or a limited partnership. Any of the times when securities are issued in the settlement of a class action, which happens often in class actions in the United States. So it's not an Agent Orange case where amorphous company with go forth and do good works in an undefined way was set up with a part of the settlement class. Cash. In this case, we know precisely what the participation of each class member is going to be. It's one share for every 10 feet. And that was the class quarter aspect of it. In addition, when the slander of title claims and the declaratory judgment claims were settled, the class members through the settlement also give permission to T-Cube to use their property. They have permission to use their property. It is not a trespass. and the terms of compensation, if their property is used, are set in advance. It's a multi-layered settlement. It gets value for class members in a variety of ways, and what this appeal has done is picked out one small piece of it. It is a piece that Judge Barker found to be valuable, but it is not the linchpin for how she decided that this total settlement was a valuable settlement for the class members. And that is the answer to that question. If I can move on to jurisdiction.
It's because you've only got 1 minute.
In jurisdiction, in 1 minute. Del Vecchio says you can look at it from the defendant's perspective. In this case, we asked for an injunction. That makes it unlike some of the other cases that this court may be familiar with. We asked for an injunction in this case. The McCarty v. Amico precedent in this case makes clear that when we're asking for an injunction of the equivalent of a pipeline, we look at it from the value of the disruption of the defendant's business. We have stated that our information is that disruption will be in excess of $75,000. We have pled that well. We have judicial admissions that, in fact, it's going to be in excess of $75,000. And in a case originally brought in federal court, unless it appears to a legal certainty that that allegation is incorrect, we have federal jurisdiction. Does the panel have any other questions?
Do you need an extra minute, Sam?
I would like an extra minute to talk about the sensibleness and the practical ability to settle a case at the slander of title stage, which also permits the use of property going forward into the future. This was a fully ripe, fully justiciable slander of title claim. The trespass was imminent at that point, and in business resolutions all the time, you settle a claim and also look to what is a fair resolution of a future relationship between you. Because we settled this case at this time, we had maximum leverage. The terms of the settlement involve compensation for non-cable side and cable side, involve compensation at a minimum of $1.16 a foot, going up to over $6 a foot, because we got for these class members a percentage of every sale that T-Cube does going into the future. We consolidated the easement rights, which gave them value and protection for the first time, and we got them cash and a declaration. It was an excellent settlement, but you don't evaluate that settlement alone. But the product coming out of the process speaks something about whether it is right and in the best interest of the class members to settle these fully ripe, justiciable slander of title claims in this way. Compare that to a settlement that is currently being proposed by Ms. Mason's counsel. It is every telecommunication company in the country, well, the five major ones, nationwide, across the board, no compensation for cable side, total transfer of easements of all class members in perpetuity to the telecommunications companies for 60 cents a foot. I do not think that this appeal turns on whether or not Class Corridor will ultimately someday be the next Microsoft. I think that this settlement provides extraordinary compensation for these class members, and one of the reasons is we settled it at the time we settled it. Thank you.
Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honor asked opposing counsel whether or not there are any other cases like this, and we heard about claims processes and sort of like and all of those kinds of answers. There are no other cases like this. There are no other cases where something's going to happen in the future, and then you'll find out upon the happening of a later event whether you're in the class or not. The only case that was like that was Amchem, which said if you end up being injured later, then yeah, you will be in this class, but right now you don't know. And counsel didn't give you the name of one case, and that's because there is none. If this court is to expand the law that far, we'll be blazing a new trail. Now, you asked about greater intrusion on the rights on the cable side. Your Honor, both sides give up the same thing. They both give up an easement. If this settlement has any value, the intrusion is going to be the same on both sides of the track. One is going to be by Corridor LLC. One is going to be by T-Cube, which is interesting. In the usual way that we settle cases, A sues B, B and A compromise. In this case, if you're on the non-cable side, you don't get anything. You don't get anything from the offending party. You get everything from this new corporation that the court has nothing to do with, and that's where you will get, if you get anything, that's where you'll get it from.
Your opponent said that class corridors would sign a document with the court and thus come under the jurisdiction of the court by virtue of this signature once it came into being.
I don't see that in the record anywhere, first of all. Second of all, in the settlement agreement...
They did say that, I'm quite sure.
Okay, I don't recall that, Your Honor, but I don't recall that. What happened was the settlement agreement was also signed by Corridor LLC. There's a signature line for it. I don't even know that it was in existence then if you read the record, but there is a signature for that. The problem with that is that it's not a party to the agreement. It's a gratuitous signature where it promises nothing. In fact, if you look at the definition of parties in the settlement agreement, the parties are specifically enumerated. And Corridor LLC is not one of those parties to the settlement agreement. The court has no ongoing jurisdiction. Is Kathy Mason a member of the class? Yes. We can go through all that, but the answer is yes.
Okay.
Now, innovation. Is it too innovative? Well, and the answer was, well, that was up to the district court to decide. And the district court said it was fair, reasonable, and adequate. Well, Judge Weinstein thought it was okay, too. He's the one who put it together and said this is a great idea. So I would suggest that the reason we're appealing is because it's... Is it innovative? Yes, it's innovative. I've said that many times in the argument. But it doesn't meet the requirements. Counsel said, we trade investment. We people get stock all the time in settlements. Well, look at the cases that are cited. Every case where a class member ends up getting a security, gets an investment, is a case where they had already invested. They had already bought some stock. Maybe they bought a limited partnership agreement. And
but
it got
why isn't the answer to that, though, simply to say that the people who haven't opted out of the settlement are, in effect, saying, yes, we think this is a good thing, and if somebody doesn't want to be in, they can opt out and see what they can do in their own?
Your Honor, if that was true, we wouldn't need fairness hearings. We would just approve settlements between learned counsel and then say, whoever doesn't opt, if you don't like it, you can opt out. We can't do it that way. The courts, I believe, Your Honor, can't operate that way. The court has a fiduciary relationship, as did Mr. Elzinga, to make sure that the absent class members are protected. I would remind the court of Phillips Petroleum versus Schutz, where there's an opt-in.
One of my favorite cases.
where there's an opt-in provision, and the court said, and I'm going to paraphrase, said that Rule 23 is there to protect the timid, protect those who are too weak, those who are not knowledgeable enough to act on behalf of themselves. That's the court's role. And the court's role is to protect them within the ambit of the law. The settlement goes beyond the ambit of the law is inappropriate. And we would ask the court that you reverse the decision of the district court.
Thank you, counsel. We will take the case under advisement, and thank you.